sunshine. Give me a do. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing Mountain Dew. So give me my good friends. Give me a do.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.
Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, where we were joined by our good friend, the New Zealand comedian, Ray O'Leary. Now, we've known Ray for a long time now. He is such a good friend. It's so good to get him on the main podcast. You might remember he did the Edinburgh Showcase that we did towards the end of last year, but he is on the full show today, and I'm absolutely certain you're going to love it because, oh my gosh, we had such a good time doing this show. Once you have finished listening to it, then I reckon you're going to want to go and buy tickets to see his show. His stand-up is really where he absolutely thrives. He's got a brilliant delivery and his jokes are so funny. Of all the people I went to see last year, definitely he's my favourite. And so if you are listening to this when the show goes out and you are in Edinburgh, Newcastle, Glasgow, Norwich, Southampton, Edinburgh, Leeds, Liverpool, Birmingham, London, Bristol or Sheffield, then go to the internet and search for Ray O'Leary. If you go to his Instagram, then you will find details for tickets in his bio, or you could just search Google for Ray O'Leary tickets and you'll find them there, and I highly recommend it. If you'd like to listen to the XL version of this show, where we find out what Dan has in common with Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and believe me, you didn't want it in the normal version, but big fans of Dan are going to want to hear it, and then go to patreon.com/nosuchthingsafish, and there is all sorts of stuff there, not just XL shows, but merch and all sorts of bonus material, or just a place to sign up and learn more about fish. Anyway, let's get on with it. This week's show with Ray O'Leary. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Andrew Hunter-Murray, James Harkin, and Ray O'Leary. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Ray.
My fact this week is that a 30-second lullaby written in 1963 has made more than $70 million in royalties.
It's pretty good going.
And that lullaby is Killing in the Name Of by Rage Against the Machine. Something that I always go to bed with.
Okay, that's a lot of royalties.
It is, yes. The reason it's made so much money is because it's become a theme song for a TV show. It's become a theme song for the American quiz show Jeopardy, because the song was written by the creator of the show, who I guess needed a theme song, and got himself to do it, and now paid himself $70 million. But
So he got paid every time it was on.
Yes, that's every time it was on. And the show is like 230 episodes a year or something. He gets paid every time.
Oh, and syndicated globally as well. And there's all the different UK and other formats.
Stephen Fry hosts the UK and Australian ones.
The thing is about this lullaby is, as far as I'm concerned, it's exactly the same as another lullaby.
Interesting.
Which is I'm a Little Teapot. Right?
Oh, really? Yeah.
It's the one that goes...
Tip me over.
Pour me out. To me, I've always heard it, and I honestly always thought... Oh, they must have just used I'm a Little Teapot because it was out of copyright.
Yeah.
But actually, he claimed to have written it.
Well, I would say that I'm a Little Teapot is not a lullaby. I certainly wouldn't sing that to a child I was trying to get to sleep. I think that's more of a hype-up fight song, that kind of thing.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
You know what I mean?
What is it?
Well, it was the 8 mile of its day.
But actually, I mean, there are movements involved. When you want a child to sleep, you don't want them doing movements.
Yeah.
But that was written by a couple of school teachers.
Really?
I think it was in like the 30s or 40s.
Oh.
So in theory, it would have been in copyright when when this guy who was called, what was he called?
Merv Griffin.
When Merv Griffin wrote his, in theory, they could have sued him. But I think because they were just school teachers, they weren't
I didn't know that.
Well, so Merv Griffin, he not only created Jeopardy, he created Wheel of Fortune. Yep. He was also the host of a lot of TV shows. He was in movies. He was a sort of business empire unto himself.
He was like the Richard Osman of America.
Yeah, he was. Okay. But I do have a bone to pick with old Merv, which is, he says creator of Jeopardy. He absolutely was not. It was his wife.
His wife,
Jewel Ann Wright. She was sitting on an airplane, and this is in interviews with Merv Griffin, where he says, and this will explain the format of Jeopardy in case anyone's not really seen it, his wife was mulling over game show ideas and said there's not enough successful question and answer shows. Those used to be big, they weren't really on TV. And then she said, what happens if you swap the answer and question in the format? So what if you were given the answer and you had to come up with the question?
So the question is... Well, how does it work, Ray? You're a fan, right?
Yeah. What you get given is, I think it's called sometimes the clue, but it's meant to be in the phrase of an answer. So it'll be, this city is the biggest in the UK and home to 9 million people or something like that.
Okay.
And then you'd say...
What is... Western Superman.
I do not know enough about British geography to understand that joke.
What is London?
Yeah, what is London? Yeah, okay.
The examples she gave on the plane was, she said 5,280. The question was, how many feet are in a mile? Yeah. She also said 79 Wistful Vista. The answer was, is that where Fibber and Molly Magee live? And that was just friends of theirs.
That's a tricky one.
That is a tough one.
I think the thing is, though, with Jeopardy is like those kind of things wouldn't quite work. Because if you say the number of feet in a mile, there's a number of different questions that could result in that answer. Whereas if it's a clue rather than an answer.
So it has to be, you can't say these are weird sea things and I say what are oysters? Because there are loads of weird little sea things.
It could be a quahog.
Exactly. Okay. Because I've always found it incredibly confusing. I've never seen an episode. I've always found the idea quite baffling.
And also, if you don't say what is or who is or whatever, you don't get the point.
Give me a break. Give me a break.
It's got to be rules.
What is the slogan for Kit Kat?
Have a break.
Close enough.
Do they have this show in New Zealand?
No, I illegally watch it on YouTube every day. Don't tell anyone. I probably shouldn't have said it, but I find it fascinating. And also, you're right about what Merv Griffin said about how he came up with the show. I was just sitting there and my wife had an idea. The shame of being single. I'm half as efficient, you know.
Well, he was like a big deal and he was an actor. And I think he was friends with Doris Day, who might have discovered him.
Oh.
I think he was working in a nightclub and Doris Day walked past and said, "Why, you should do a screen test for Warner Brothers, for whom I'm working." And he did that and he got put in a couple of movies. And I think he probably thought he was going to be Doris Day's leading man because they were such good friends. But he was very short. He could have been like her love interest who eventually loses the girl, but he was never going to be a leading man, really.
So he thought he was going in to be the hot man, but he was assigned, what, like Hunchback number two? Doris Day signed him in.
He was a pallbearer at Ronald Reagan's funeral. Maybe through acting connections, I don't know, or maybe after he became a very big deal.
He can't have been that short then.
No, you're right.
You have to
unless they all were. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. And he's the man behind the song "I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts."
No.
He was the original singer of the one who made it the big song that it became.
Isn't that good?
That's crazy.
So not behind it. Sorry, one of the singers who made it big. And the other thing about him, just last thing on him personally that I found fascinating was he also created, as you said, I think James, Wheel of Fortune, which is another incredibly big game show. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that the theme tune for that show was written by Alan Thicke, father of Robin Thicke.
A friend of the podcast.
Do you know Robin Thicke?
I know Robin Thicke.
No, common misconception.
Yeah.
On this podcast, he will always be Robin Thicke.
He gets furious people mispronouncing his name.
Robin Thicke.
Because it makes him sound thick if you call him Robin Thicke. That's not how it's said.
He's a very clever man.
He also had a chat show, very famously, Merv. Yeah. He interviewed an estimated 25,000 people. And he said that his best interview was with Orson Welles, because Orson Welles was a very guarded individual. He didn't really say anything about his personal life. But just before the show, Orson Welles said, "You know these wonderful gossipy things that you've always wanted to ask about my past? And Merv says, yeah, yeah, but I'm not allowed to ask those, am I? And Orson Welles says, well, tonight you are. I'm feeling very expansive. And he did the interview and he asked him all these questions that he wouldn't answer in the past. And Orson Welles went home and died 2 hours later.
Whoa.
So he was like, this is my last chance to get it out.
Wow.
Holy moly.
Well, he died of natural causes as opposed to...
Merv Griffin murdered him for ratings.
We mentioned Wheel of Fortune earlier.
Yep.
There is a person on that show called Vanna White who has a Guinness World Record.
Okay.
Can you guess what it is?
Vanna White. Vanna White was a... She was quite a glamorous lady.
Glamorous assistant.
I was going to get... Is it something like most hours on TV?
Okay, so she is the person who turns the answers around because Wheel of Fortune is like Hangman, right? So you've got word there and you say, can I have an X? Yes, you can, and they'll turn the X
around. But there might not be that letter there if it's not in the phrase you're looking for. I understand. I can play
So it's this person's job. But she now has a world record. And she's done something 3,721,446 times as of the 9th of February 2015.
Is it touching letters?
The world record of touching letters.
Because, A, Santa's got that record absolutely down pat.
Has she clapped?
Correct.
No.
Yeah, so whenever they get one of the letters right, she turns it around and she claps.
But someone's counted the claps.
Wow, which poor Guinness worker had to sit watching every episode.
And she appeared in all but 10 of the 6,151 episodes up until Guinness made this record.
Wow, good.
And she clapped in all of them and she had a world record.
Wow.
And the reason that they had a hostess on there at all is because they were going to motorize the board, which is what you would do. Right. It's like, can I have an L? And the L just turns round. Yeah. But they couldn't finish making the motor, and so they had to hire someone to actually turn the pictures.
Just on computers doing this kind of stuff. So Jeopardy famously faced Watson in 2011, supercomputer.
Did
it?
Yeah, and Watson won, beat two humans who were playing alongside it. It's a three-player game, isn't it?
And one of them was like the best.
They were both they're top champions. Yeah. Uh-huh. Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter, who I think both hold records in the Jeopardy universe.
Really?
I didn't know there was a Jeopardy universe.
JCU? You ever checked it out? There's a website called J Archive, and that it's a fan-made website, and it's a record of every question ever asked, how much dollar values were wagered and whatnot, who won, pictures of the people who played, every like word that was said on an episode, all categorized there. And Alex Trebek, one of the longtime hosts of the show, found out about it, and he said, come on, people, get a life.
What is biting the hand that feeds you? Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everyone. We'd like to let you know that this week we are sponsored by Saylee.
That's right. Saylee, the new eSIM service app, which means that if you were going overseas on holiday or a business trip and you've got your mobile phone on you, you can download an eSIM that would allow you to get the best local rates for any of the phone calls that you're making so you don't rack up a bill of thousands and thousands like one of us on the podcast has definitely done.
Well, certainly it wasn't me, Dan, because I've known about Saylee for a long time, and I just can't imagine Andy or Anna would be quite so careless.
This is why you were a loss to the police, James. I think you've very quickly mapped out who it was. It was me. It cost a fortune, and now that doesn't happen because there is over 200 destinations where eSaylee applies to. And I am now an eSaylee user.
Yeah, you just download the Saylee app onto your mobile device and it's really easy to find your data plan, apply your coupon code and get an exclusive discount. And Dan, what is that coupon code?
That coupon code is FISH. So download the Saylee app, use that code FISH at checkout and you're going to get 15% off your first purchase.
Absolutely. Get an exclusive 50% discount on your first Saylee data plans. Use the code FISH at checkout and download the Saylee app or go to https://Saylee.com/FISH and be like me, Andy and Anna.
Okay, on with the podcast.
On with the show.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that every year in Japan, thousands of receptionists apply to compete against each other in the All Japan Phone Answering Championship. This is amazing. This is a competition exclusively for office workers, mostly receptionists. And every year, literally thousands and thousands apply so that they could go to a competition where they sit on stage and they are judged on how well they receive a phone call and deal with questions. And it lasts 3 minutes long for each of them. And then they hang up and then a decision is made on how great they performed. And they're given things like a problem, it's called, each year. A new problem is created. And they are given...
Is it the same problem for all competitors?
Yeah,
it is.
It is.
But you would not be able to... You must be kept away from... Otherwise, you see what the problem is.
I think they tell you before you go on. Because there's like... So the 2025 one was for a theoretical beef tongue restaurant in Sendai City. which has the slogan "Bringing smiles to customers' faces through beef tongue," and basically, you get all the menus and all the different places it can deliver beef tongues to, and then someone will ring up going, "Excuse me, do you have any pork tongue?" And you have to like answer that.
I'm a vegetarian. What do you have for me?
And you're told what's going to be asked as well. You're told the problem, so there's no plot twists or anything like that. You're even given a role in that 2025 one. You are Yun Katakura. You are an employee responsible for operating the online shop and handling inquiries about beef tongue. And
but you have to do it with a straight face. but I think it's like a lot of it's like how polite you are, it's how clear you are.
It sounds like there's a lot of quite formal etiquette as well.
Very
and
much
and
so.
In terms of how you answer the phone, you're meant to answer on the first or the second ring. If you only get to it on the third ring, that's an apology straight away.
And yeah. if you pick it up straight away and you're too keen on the beef tongue.
I think it's very precise.
If you're in a phone answering competition and you're waiting for the third ring, I mean, that's crazy. Yeah,
that's the bad boy entry, isn't it? Yeah.
I think you're talking general Japanese etiquette within all these places.
Yes.
Yeah, it's apparently it's judged out of 100 points. I got this from a translation of a site that talks about the 2025 competition. So yeah, it's judged on 6 different criteria. First impression. The first line that you say,
hello,
did you deal with that? Criteria number 2, basic call handling skills, which is 20 points. Voice volume, speaking speed, natural intonation, clear voice production and pronunciation. That's what that one is.
Well, it's important.
Yeah. Then there's communication skills. There's provision of information and service. Final impression.
Bye.
All right, Andy, let's just try with you, okay?
Yes.
Bling, bling.
Hello.
Sorry, that was a bit quick.
That's keen.
And also, in Japan, they don't say hello.
So we need you to do the full voice.
In Japan, you answer the phone, moshi moshi.
Oh, of course.
And do you know why that is?
It's because they speak Japanese.
That is undoubtedly true, but it doesn't mean hello.
Okay. Oh.
It means, it's short for amaushi agemasu, which means I am going to talk. It's because in polite Japanese society, especially if you're speaking to someone who is more important than you, you wouldn't say hello. You had to announce the fact that you want to talk before you do.
Which is tough because then you are talking. So you surely need to say moshi moshi before you say moshi moshi.
Yeah,
can I ask a question? Is the Japanese?
You are asking a question.
Nightmare.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there's another theory. According to a folklorist called Yue Kasal, apparently moshi moshi is impossible to say if you are a magic fox. So
the life of the magic fox just gets harder and harder.
There's a thing called the Bakemono fox, and this fox is like a trickster in folklore. And one thing that it does is it can learn to speak like and imitate a human, but it can say lots of the words, but it can't say moshi moshi. And so according to this folklorist, one of the reasons people say moshi moshi is because then if they say that, they know that you're not a magic fox.
Shibboleth. right?
A shibboleth, yeah. Exactly.
And as a result, Magic Fox crime stats are down, way down in Japan.
Especially when it comes to like phishing, like trying to get your bank details on yeah. the phone. Yeah. They just don't do it.
A lot of younger Japanese people, and I think this is a global thing as well, are becoming more nervous about answering the phone.
Mm-hmm.
This is a thing. There was a study in the UK that found that a quarter of people aged 18 to 34 never answer the phone.
If it's an unknown number?
I would never answer to an unknown number.
Really?
I don't either.
I do. I like it. I spin the wheel. You know, who's this?
Yeah, but it's always some spam, isn't it?
It's often someone with a really good offer for me, actually.
And that's why Andy's living in the basement of this building.
Another Magic Fox got me again.
But there's this other thing that is happening now, especially with younger people answering the phone, is they answer the phone. They'll answer it, but they won't say anything because they're waiting for it if it's a scam call. Do you?
Because you can kind of hear the click. And also what happens often is they won't say anything. And then as soon as you talk, then the automatic voice comes in.
And it says, hello, I've got a great deal for you.
50,000 kilos of beef tongue.
Yes, yes, yes.
You had me at hello.
But have you guys experienced this other thing? And this has only been recently launched. Yelp, the sort of phone people, the company, launched this thing recently. You can have a proper conversation with an AI voice that answers your phone. So I'm in the process of, I'm getting my hob removed. And
sorry.
Excuse me. I'm trying to have my hob ripped out at the moment.
It's filth.
Yeah.
I can't believe you showed up to work today. I was wondering why you're limping up the stairs.
And I phoned up this company trying to get a quote. And I had a whole conversation with a robot that was doing a quote for me.
Oh.
Like saying, what's the size of it and what shape is it? But as in, I had a proper chat. I found it very upsetting and horrible.
Sometimes that's how I feel when we're doing this podcast.
You know that you're not talking to a proper intelligence. But... yeah.
Could you tell it was an AI or was it?
No,
it have good intonations, good production of speech, good whatever the.
Well, it did, but weirdly, I could tell.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. As in, it sounded like a person, but there was just a slight sort of filter over the whole call that made me realize it was a machine talking.
Wow. It's really weird because the final criteria, the sixth criteria of this whole thing, is actually sort of an overall evaluation. So it sort of almost doesn't matter what happened between 1 and 5. They could have given you high marks, but then they're like, now that I think about it, I wasn't so much impressed with these certain moments. And you can get points for even if you didn't get anything resolved in the call, but it sounded like a nice chat. You get points for that. You can also get points for excellent silence. Just for like, wow,
no way.
You were brilliant with the silence there. Yeah. Points for everyone.
I was wondering who would be the first to crack that.
I looked it up, and I think it was the 2015 winner. She practiced to win this competition. She practiced her 3-minute conversations for 2 hours a day over a period of 4 months.
That's a very patient partner. That
crazy.
That's amazing. Well, it is thousands who apply, but it's only about 60 to 80 that make it to the actual stage.
I guess,
you know,
is there an audience? Is there a big audience apart from the judges?
I've seen a video, but I've only seen it of the stage. I couldn't quite tell.
Because if the show is 60 to 80 people doing the same 3-minute conversation, I can imagine that wouldn't be very varied, basically.
Yeah.
I did read that one of the recent winners answered the phone and conducted the conversation in a very traditional and formal style, which is what got her the points with the judges, although you wouldn't maybe naturally have a conversation like that if you were answering the phone. And in a normal Japanese business, basically. All right. There are all sorts of... apparently there are at least 60 books in Japan available exclusively on phone etiquette.
Yeah.
It's a real thing. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's a country with a huge amount of etiquette in all sorts of areas. But yeah, it's fascinating. General reception? I was trying to find out some more things about general receptionists and receptionism.
Okay, go on.
Oh, okay.
Most successful receptionist of all time?
Okay. Good question. Is it the receptionist from The Apprentice TV show in the UK who literally, well, they they have this whole pretense of them being in the boardroom and you're fired and stuff, and then right. they go out and then supposedly Alan Sugar decides what's going to happen, and then they cut to someone who doesn't even seem to be in the same building picking up a phone and going, yes, Lord Sugar, I'll send them in now.
Oh, boy.
And then put it, and then they cut to the boardroom and they're all in. So that just feels like quite a good job.
Yeah. Great gig. Yeah, that's really good. No, the Queen.
She was a receptionist.
Oh, the current Queen consort. Camilla.
Oh, Camilla. Oh,
Camilla started out as a receptionist. Yeah. I mean,
it's a natural career progression, isn't it?
Or being promoted.
You're made queen.
Did she?
Yeah.
Interesting.
She works at obviously a very posh company in their reception, and I think she was sacked for turning up late. But I found out, interesting fact, Charles and Camilla had the same gynecologist when they were born.
What? Charles had a gynecologist?
I suppose Charles and Camilla's mothers were both assisted by the same.
Yeah. Okay.
Charles has no gynecologist.
Yeah, he had his hob removed, actually.
Oh, my gosh. Here is an accidental receptionist in Reykjavik in 2015. There was a security guard in the Prime Minister's office who went away from the office for the day. But normally what you do is you put your mobile phone number into the system, and then if anyone phones the Prime Minister, then it would come through to you and you can sort of take messages and whatever.
Right.
Anyway, someone put the wrong number in, and a woman who lived in Reykjavik just started getting phone calls that were meant for the Prime Minister of Iceland.
That's such a good prank.
So funny. Yeah.
If you can arrange that for someone, that is amazing.
Yeah.
What happened? What did you
do? Nothing. It was just for like one day or so until they all came back in the office, and she said, "It's been no bother." This is Ingebjörg Sigurvinsdottir. Said, "It's been no bother. I am a citizen of this country and I am ready to help."
Right.
But just imagine if you've been like invasion that
patching
day.
Through calls that, like, from like world leaders and things.
Yeah.
I really like this, which is ELO, Electric Light Orchestra. It's one of my favorite bands.
Right.
So their debut album came out in 1971. It's called Electric Light Orchestra, out here in the UK. Released in America in March of 1972 with the title No Answer. And that's because the record exec in America said to someone in the office, "Can you call England and find out what the debut album is called?" They called, no one picked up. They wrote in the notes, "No answer."
No.
The exec saw that and thought, "Oh, great title." And that became the title of the album.
What was the title in the UK?
It was just self-titled.
ELO. Is that because someone rang up the office and they went, "Hello"?
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, one of the most important figures of the Enlightenment, father of European political thought, and one of the inspirations behind the French Revolution, would run around Paris with his bum out, hoping someone would spank him.
Did that start the French Revolution? We have to stop this guy.
Off with his bum. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, unbelievably famous in his time, one of the most important thinkers of the age. And it turned out that he had a pretty difficult childhood, and it stuck him with some fetishes. And one of them was that he loved being spanked. And just before he died, he had a book called Confessions, which was very autobiographical, but it was warts and all. And he said that he would go around Paris, Winnie the Pooh style, hoping that someone would spank him. And then what happened was sometimes he got the shit beat out of him.
Did he?
Yeah, like a group of people who didn't think much of that kind of thing would grab hold of him and start kicking him, and he'd have to escape.
I think that's fair.
Yeah,
He was hanging around in alleys,
hoping
for, I presume, what would be quite a rare result was someone to administer a spanking. I mean, it's sort of,
I'd be in a Punisher right here and now.
It feels like a behaviour that would be looked down upon these days.
Yeah, you probably couldn't even do that anymore. Yeah, because of woke. It does feel like famous philosopher pervert, which is a smaller headline, you know.
Yeah.
And then it's like,
yeah,
It's striking that he confessed it.
Yeah, his confessions were really sort of like I'm going to admit everything now.
Yeah.
But this, yeah, so his confessions, he wrote what is largely seen as the first autobiography. It's often said to be the first autobiography. And he would go around to parties and he would read extracts of his confessions. Mm. So he titled it Confessions, I believe.
Yeah, Confessions of a Smack Addict. I think that was the...
It's so funny that he was mooning people in alleyway. Do you think they looked down an alleyway and they go, inside that alleyway, is there a smaller, narrower alleyway?
Oh my gosh.
But yes, he did publish the first, what is considered the first autobiography, The Confessions, and he discussed some of his least glamorous moments, which included that he abandoned 5 of his children. And that he once stole a ribbon. So those two were sort of on equal to... But the ribbon thing, he did, I think, accuse a... he said that a maiden, another servant, had stolen it and given it to him, and that's how he came across it.
He's an interesting cookie, isn't he? He kind of...
Ray, just for context, this is what Dan says about some of the worst people you've ever heard of.
He was a character.
Jack the Ripper. Real strong cookie.
He's Marmite.
So he was from Geneva. And his father was also from Geneva, but he had this sort of idea that he was from some incredible patrician family. Very important, he felt he was. He was a watchmaker, but he married above his station, and he thought he was so upper class that he always brandished a sword wherever he went. That was not allowed in Geneva at the time.
Okay.
So he got kicked out of Geneva, and the whole family got kicked out.
Gosh.
And eventually Rousseau was sent to live with a Calvinist minister and his daughter. And it was the daughter, Mademoiselle Lambercier, who used to treat him like he was her child, and she would spank him when he'd done something naughty. And then in the end, he would just do things naughty deliberately so that he got spanked.
Yeah.
And that's how he ended up with this.
It's so what, because his most famous quote is, man is born free, but everywhere he is in chains. Mm. And I assumed the chains were meant to be bad, but now thinking like maybe he was quite a good man, but everywhere he's in chains and, you know, hopefully a whip or maybe a...
Man has been a very, very naughty boy. But he also believed that there was this idea of the natural man and that civilization was actually a complete con job that made everyone miserable.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very...
And we would all be really happy if we were just left to live our own lives and we didn't have to go to work every day and get on the tube and...
Yeah. And but basically, he just thought anything that was an invention of modern society was bad. And that's why he thought... And so it's really weird that he was a great writer about childhood, considering that he abandoned all of his children to an orphanage. But he kind of overturned a previous very prevailing view that children are naturally evil and naturally fallen, you know, born with original sin. Right. He was saying, no, children are naturally wonderful and should just be left alone, which is not a recipe for good adults. So you read a lot about philosophers. Was he a particular interest of yours?
Yes, a little bit. We didn't get him as much, and so this was interesting reading up on him.
Do you rate him as a philosopher?
He's the influence he's had is crazy, and like his development on the social contract theory and his ideas about democracy. I mean, it almost seems quaint now looking back at a guy who's writing, I think democracy would be a good idea. But, you know, at the time, you know, it was like divine right of kings, you know, this idea that, you know, the government didn't have to be responsible to its people. So it is, he was groundbreaking, I think, for the time.
Sure.
But but I didn't realize just how crazy his life was. Like I learned that his mother, Suzanne, she had to go to a church hearing. I think they had sort of like a religious, I don't know, police system in Geneva at the time, and she had to go to a church hearing for going to the street theatre disguised as a peasant woman so she could gaze upon M. Vincent Saracen, whom she fancied despite him being married. And apparently theatre was illegal at the time, so the Genevan Calvinists, she had to account for herself.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He didn't like theatre either, Jean-Jacques. Voltaire introduced a theatre to Geneva, at which point Rousseau wrote to him, "You have ruined Geneva. I hate you."
He once pissed in his neighbor's kettle.
Did he?
Yeah, that's in his confessions. I don't know if he read that out at the,
imagine
at the party.
His neighbour picks up the book, goes to the index at the back, looks, oh, I've been mentioned. That's nice. Plot, drinking his cup of tea. Spits it out. he didn't like gender equality. He was very much of the idea that men are in charge and women are not. And there was another philosopher called Olympe de Gouges, who was a French activist and playwright. And she really liked Rousseau's philosophy in general, but she really critiqued his idea that women shouldn't have as much role in society. And she said, if a woman has a right to mount the scaffold, she must equally have the right to mount the speaker's platform.
Yes.
And then 2 years later, she was executed.
No.
So
French Revolution.
In the Reign of Terror.
Damn.
For political writings, which was a little bit frowned upon at the time.
Mary Wollstonecraft as well. Author of Vindication of the Rights of Women. She and
Mary
Rousseau,
Shelley's mum.
Mary Shelley's mum. She and he had big beef because it. Again, all part of his theory that the natural is perfect. He then wrote, oh, well, actually, you know, it's women's nature to give care, and that's therefore all they should be taught to do. It was a very regressive theory, even at the time, and Wollstonecraft argued back pretty stiffly. But Rousseau inspired the journey that produced Frankenstein.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. So, you know, Mary Shelley and
Byron
and Percy Shelley went to Lake Geneva. They went to Lake Geneva in 1816. They were following in the footsteps of one of his novels, which was called Julie.
Wow.
And it's set at the eastern end of Lake Geneva. And they were going on a bit of a, I don't know what the term is, where
like
you sort of recreate.
Almost.
Yeah, kind of. They were following that. And so that's why they ended up there.
Oh,
amazing.
Cool.
I didn't know that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Rousseau's dad, back to being a watchmaker, he said, just a random burn from his father, Mr. Rousseau said, a Genevan watchmaker is a man who can be introduced anywhere. A Parisian watchmaker is only fit to talk about watches. So there's a hardcore burn amongst the watchmaking community of 1700s Geneva.
I wouldn't associate France with watchmaking, probably for that reason, right?
Yeah.
Swiss watchmaking, of course.
Yes.
A French cuckoo clock maker is only fit to talk about cuckoo clocks. A Swiss cuckoo clock maker.
A French Toblerone maker is.
Okay, it's time for our final fact of the show, and that is Andy.
My fact is rays flirt by belly flopping.
I told you that in confidence.
Like a manta ray?
Like a manta ray.
Or a stingray? Or...
There are all sorts of... I think there are 11 different species of mobular ray, which are the great big diamond-shaped rays that you get, with a mouth at one end and a tail at the other and two enormous lovely wings in between. And some of the species, specifically monk's devil ray, but I think a few of them do it, they do these incredible ballet displays out of the water. They gather in big groups and then they just launch themselves out and they go about 2 meters into the air. And these are huge animals as well. Yeah. Like they're big. And they land with this great big splash and they do it for hours at a time. And when I say flirt, scientists are reasonably confident it's communication.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it might be a way of luring more rays to your ray mating event.
Okay.
Sorry, Ray.
Is that what you call it, Ray?
It's often quite a solo affair. I don't know how these guys are. What do they have that I don't?
There are hundreds of them in there. Sorry. Sorry to rub it in.
All belly flopping around without me.
So it might be flirting, basically. It might be hunting, but it seems to be communicating
something.
They're
not sure. The mating habits of rays. Have you heard of the manta train?
Oh.
No.
This is manta rays.
There's a rail replacement manta bus, I'm afraid, today.
This is a way of courting that happens amongst manta rays where a female will swim up front and she'll be followed by a train of male mantas swimming behind her.
Like a conga.
Yeah, exactly like a conga. And
they should have called it the conga reel. That would have been a clever...
Yes.
It would have been confusing.
It would have been very confusing. Yeah.
And the idea is that they just follow, and it can last a very long time, sometimes several weeks, where they're just following and then they'll sleep and then follow and so on.
You know
on.
What? This weekend, I saw a conga of caterpillars.
Did you?
There must have been 30 if there was two, and there was two.
That's fantastic.
It was in a car park in Spain. And they were just walking like arse to nose, arse to nose, arse to nose. And they were all just wandering along. And I Googled it. And apparently they're looking for mating grounds or food or something. But they always go in this sort of conga line.
Were they heading... Were they near the edge of the car park?
No, they
were.
Oh, no. It was tough.
I just love the thought of you're on holiday in Spain and everyone's going, oh, where's James? Oh, he's at the car park watching some caterpillars.
Just behind all the caterpillars going.
Oh, dear.
But it was cool, though.
That is cool.
You see this line on the road. You know what it is. And the closer you get, the more you realize that it's these caterpillars.
Yeah. Well, this sounds like a pretty amazing thing to witness. And scientists do watch it. The story I read. Yeah, the manta rays, where 20 rays were following the main lady who's called Big Bertha. They name all the rays. Because there's Miles Ray. They said she was being closely followed by Miles Ray. We thought that he was the one for her. Later on, when we checked out the footage, we found out Lightning Ray had pursued her on his own.
I'm thinking of a few new nicknames for myself. If you guys could start calling me Lightning Ray.
That's what they do. And they battle it out or whoever lasts till the end.
I'd also recommend to anyone listening to this, it is not a smart flirting strategy to follow a woman for weeks at a time. Be your friends.
There was in 2024 there was a ray who managed to successfully mate on their own, and there was a female stingray living with a load of male sharks, and she became pregnant. And what a lot of people thought is maybe she'd been impregnated by the sharks.
What?
Because she had like bite marks on the side of her, and that's quite often sharks will bite when they're mating to kind of get a grip. But I think generally speaking, what we think has happened now is that she got pregnant through parthenogenesis.
Whoa.
Females have their egg cells, but they also have another thing in their body called polar bodies. And these contain genes as well. And if there are no males around, then the polar bodies can get into the eggs and they can then turn into
fetuses. Oh, wow. With virgin birth.
It's virgin.
It's even crazier in a way.
There are some rays, but it sounds like it's not this one, because otherwise it might have been mentioned, that can sort of hold and incubate the sperm that they collect, and that can be held for quite some time.
Cryptic female choice.
Yeah, exactly. No. Yeah, that's what I would have thought it was, but clearly...
No. Yeah, well, I don't know. Like, the scientists are still not certain, but they think it's this kind of polar body thing.
Rays in general, said there are, what did I say? I said 11 species of mobular ray, and they're known as the mobulids, which is a great name. So three of those species are manta rays, and the other eight are devil rays, right? Mm-hmm. Sorry, Ray.
Nickname. Good nickname.
But they've been recategorized a lot lately, and I think the last time we talked about them was about 8 years ago. They had just been all shaken up and redistributed and rearranged scientifically into new categories.
Was it your fact there's no such thing as a ray or something?
And so the newest manta ray was discovered in 2025, last year. We're still discovering these things are massive as well.
Wow.
And it was by a scientist called Andrea Marshall. The Atlantic manta ray is the third species of manta ray that we now know about. And back in 2009, she had observed it and thought it was a bit fishy. And it's taken until now to prove it, right? And to sort of demonstrate it and sort of do the analysis to show that it's a separate species. The amazing thing was, in 2009, she and her colleagues had also first described the second species of manta ray.
Right.
Uh-huh. I just think it's amazing. And the reason it's so hard to scientifically describe them is that what do you need to describe a new species?
You need to know that it's not the same as an old species.
Yep. But what's the way of proving it is what I mean.
Oh, genetic testing?
Yes, but what do you need to do genetic testing?
Some genetic material.
You need a body.
Oh, okay.
Right. And these things... they're really hard to study, A, because when they die, they sink.
Oh.
Nightmare. And secondly, they're made of cartilage, not bone, which decomposes faster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's bloody hard to get hold of a sample.
Yeah.
And they're still quite mysterious. They're still quite
strange
alien things. And it just takes a very long time to find one that's washed up
and
get it to a scientist in time, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Can I quickly point out, you did do a fact, no such thing as a ray, on the show ages ago. And I think that applies right here, right now.
What?
Aren't I right?
Oh.
Matthew.
Oh. Uh-oh.
Oh, my God. Out. Oh, no.
You're not a real Ray.
No, that is true.
You're
that
a fake Ray.
That's true.
Ray Charlatan.
It's true. It's a nickname.
Do you know why he's called Ray? His real name's Matthew. He's called Ray because he sounds like Ray Romano. That's what one of his friends thought at school.
From Everybody Loves Raymond. And they all just started calling me Ray. And that's how it's caught on. And no one's genetically tested me yet. We don't, no one's noticed that I'm not a genetically different species to Ray Romano.
Do you know that Ray Romano really hated the name of that show?
Yeah.
Everybody Loves Raymond. And he hated it so much that he kept saying to the producers, we need to change this title. And they made a deal with him, apparently, that if they made it as into a top 10 show, they will change the name. And then they did it for a few years, became more and more successful. Eventually, they cracked the top 10. He went into the producers and said, right, we've got a deal. It's time to change the name. And they said, well, we can't change it now. It's a top 10 show.
Oh, man. That's so funny. That's great. Everyone loves Raymond. Ray hated that name. Here's another one. Ray Parker Jr. You heard of him?
Ghostbusters.
Wrote the song Ghostbusters.
Yes.
Turns out, revealed in an interview recently, he is afraid of ghosts.
You're busting myth after myth today, Dan.
I trusted him.
And he used to be a solo artist called Radio. That's a cool nickname.
That is a cool name. Yeah. They can be huge, Rays. They can be 17 feet long. That's a giant devil ray. I mean, that's really, really big.
Is that is their wingspan bigger than their length?
They're usually about the same, aren't they? They're like squares.
They're diamonds.
Yeah.
Yes.
But a manta ray 10 feet long needs to eat about, well, I suppose any manta ray needs to eat about 12% of its body weight every week, right?
Every week. Okay.
That's not much.
I don't fully know. Like, what do we have to eat?
Well, let's say you weigh 100 kilos, it'll be less than that. So that'd be 12 kilos worth of food a week, which is less than 2 kilos per day.
2 kilos feels like a lot. I'm thinking of my chocolate cereal in the morning. I'm thinking of my
If you
muffin.
Buy a steak, it would be like 250 grams, right?
Yeah, that's good. So that is a fair bit.
So you'd have to eat eight and a bit steaks every day.
Okay.
So that is a fair bit.
I'm thinking of 10 kg of potatoes plus a little bit more.
Right.
We all have our ways of visualizing.
Yeah. Well, I was on mantarayadvocates.com, which is a cracking website. You may have found it in the course of your research.
Wow. I'm on the Devil Rays Advocates.
The Devil's Advocates, right?
Yeah.
I love it.
Thank you.
But they can only eat plankton. They can't eat a 250-gram steak. They eat zooplankton, tiny, tiny things in the water.
Mm. Yeah.
And mantarayadvocates.com calculated that a 10-foot ray would need to eat how many pieces of plankton a week?
This is a guessing game.
Yeah.
10 million.
Little teapot short. Oh, great. Okay. 10 million.
1.2 feet of plankton.
Okay. You've done it in a different unit, and that's fine. Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, very clever. Yeah.
Sorry, can you just explain that for the rest of us, Andy?
Dan?
Pass.
Okay. Well, James is closest because he answered in the unit that I was expecting people to answer in. You say 10 million?
10 million.
19.2 million. Right. 19 million, 200,000.
That's pretty good. It's an order of magnitude.
Yeah, I could be right, depending on how. Anyway,
we do need to check the math on rays first before we award that to James.
Let's go find some plankton.
But they have to keep swimming forward as they eat because they're a thing called obligate ram ventilators.
So the water goes through them and they take the air out of it. Is that
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. They
like dolphins?
Some ancient sharks will do this. Like, you just have to keep moving forwards, otherwise you die.
Yeah.
Which is quite cool. I think that's quite a good,
It's a good metaphor for life, isn't it? If you stand still.
The reason I thought dolphins is they sleep half brain at a time so that they can still swim.
I don't think that's to do with the breathing, though.
I think that might be more to hide from predators and stuff.
Because dolphins have to surface, obviously.
But so how do rays sleep?
Don't know.
Right?
Comfortably, but after going through every social faux pas I made that day.
One quick thing on belly flopping.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever heard the idea that if you belly flop from a very high position and then land on water, it's just as bad as landing on concrete?
Yeah.
Do you think it's true?
Yes.
I keep seeing videos now of people diving from very high heights in a belly flop position and landing in the kind of in that.
So you think no?
And yeah.
there's that rumor, I suppose you'd say, that if you throw something before you land, it breaks the tension of the water and then you can hit it.
Yes,
but
true.
My feeling is the answer is no, but it still hurts a lot.
I think that's fair. I think that's probably right. Mythbusters, our friends at Mythbusters, they did some tests and threw two big pig carcasses out of a helicopter. And they x-rayed it and they found that the pavement drop resulted in 17 fractures, a shattered pelvis and a decapitation, while the water drop yielded 7 fractures and a broken neck.
Wow. Oh, yikes.
So neither of them's good for you, but definitely hitting the pavement is more of an impact.
And that's what I suppose that's why Olympic swimming is the way it is, with water at the bottom instead of concrete.
Yeah. Yeah. In,
what's you very rarely see an Olympic diver just smash on the water, do you?
Yeah. So that's why they fill the pool with water.
Yeah,
great. Mystery solved.
One last thing from me. January 15th, 1990, Lottie Stevens was out on a boat in New Caledonia when his boat capsized. And according to the story, as reported by Radio Vanuatu, he was drifting for 4 days before a giant stingray came and gave him a ride back to land.
Wow.
Yeah.
Guy's living some Avatar shit right there.
Ray, are you not the face of Vanuatu at the moment?
Yeah, I'm the face of Vanuatu tourism.
What do you mean?
Because I found this guy floating at sea.
Are you really connected to Vanuatu?
Yeah, I did a tourism campaign for Vanuatu last year.
You could meet Lottie Stevens, because I'd love to know more. The stingray carried him for 450 miles back to shore. It took 13 days of being carried on the back of the stingray before they got home. That's so wonderful.
We didn't emphasize that part in the tourism campaign. Swim out as far as you like. Don't you worry. There's stuff out there. It'll bring you back.
You'll be back. Okay, that is it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found online. I'm on Instagram on @Schreiberland. James?
My Instagram is no such thing as James Harkin.
Andy?
Mine is @AndrewHunterM.
And Ray?
@RayO'LearyComedy.
Oh, nice. And Ray, so you're on tour in the UK right now.
Yes, hitting all over the beautiful British Isles and Ireland and even maybe Barcelona. But yes, we're going to, if there's a city nearby, I'll probably be there.
And that's in February?
March this year, yes.
In the UK.
And then Australia the rest of the year.
Okay, cool. Check it out online, everyone. Go find the date. See if Ray's coming to a town near you. Or should I say Matthew? definitely go see his show. And if you want to get in contact with us generally as a group, podcast@qi.com, send us your emails there. We will be reading the best of those out on our special show. Drop us a line, which is part of Club Fish. That's our secret members club. It's a place where we do extra stuff. It's on Patreon. So if you want to check it out, patreon.com/nosuchthingasafish. You can also send in your favorite facts, because we have our Monday show, Little Fish, where we put down our facts and we read the best of your facts. So do send them there. And otherwise, just come back next week, because we're going to be back here with another episode. And quickly, huge thanks once again to our team here, Liang Lee and Ethan Ruparelia, as well as all the bigger Fishbuster gang. And we'll see you again next week. Goodbye.